Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-host Tom Coffey and Scott Hoag. And we wanted to let our audience know that sponsorship is available for the podcast. And so if your company has IPv6 support, we want to hear about it, and you should come on and sponsor a show. If you're interested, you can go to the packetpushers.net/sponsorship page and get all the details. And we really look forward to having you on, hearing all about how you rock IPv6. So I think our discussion today is actually talking about IPv6 only. And so maybe we can jump in and chit-chat about V6 only and what goes into that and operational issues and things you need to think about and scratch your head and maybe even why in the world you would do IPv6 only to begin with.
Well, yeah, you got to warn the listeners. Our initial title for this was what? You be crazy? IPv6 only. You be crazy. And
what's
here's
wrong
how to deploy
with IPv4? There's nothing wrong with IPv4.
Well, there is nothing wrong with IPv4. Clearly, the vast majority of the internet's running on it, right?
Right.
So I think that's maybe a good starting point is why would you evaluate IPv6 only? I mean, we've talked back and forth, and we've had in the past, I think, Veronica McCullough on for talking about some of the initiatives she was doing on IPv6 only. But maybe we give a few recaps and talk about maybe some of the advantages around doing V6 only.
Yeah, I think you can start by just talking a little bit about the service providers and why they're trying desperately in some cases to get IPv4 entirely off the network if it's not running as a service in IPv6.
Yeah. Well, let's describe running V4 as a service. So basically, we're providing V4 on top of IPv6 as a service to be delivered where it's needed. So it's only deployed and actually operational at the sort of edge to, you know, overlay on top of and then back out to be able to provide V4 resource on top of a V6 only running network, right? That's mm-hmm. really what we're talking about for V4 as a service.
And that's really an inversion of what we used to do with IPv6, or what right. still happens with yep. IPv6 in some cases, but IPv6 at the edge to the IPv4 internet core, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's basically, you know, you're just doing a tunneling or overlay, depending on what works for your particular organization, how you're set up. But I think that really is solving sorts of two sets of operational problems for service providers. Number one, they're not running two protocols all over the place, right? So from administrative and organizational sort of, you know, reducing complexity within the network, you're running a single protocol, you're going to get, you know, some efficiencies out of doing that. And then you're just providing something as a service on top of it, mm-hmm. which doesn't look any different than how they're providing many other services on top of their underlay network. So I think those are important sort of points. So they're not dual stacked everywhere, they're single stacked, and they can reduce their complexity because of that. So that's the first one, right?
Yeah, reduce admin overhead. Yeah, because you've reduced the complexity. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then what I would say probably secondarily is you may be in a region of the world where you don't have enough V4 to operate anyway. And so maybe the great example of that is in India with Reliance Jio, right? And what they did to deploy basically a brand new from startup a mobile provider for the India marketplace. And you got a, you know, billion plus potential customers. We can't give you enough V4 address space to operate and run a network that large. In today's environment anyway. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do to address that shortfall? Well, you basically deploy V6, you run a V6 only network, and you provide V4, just like we talked about, as a service to be able to get those sets of customers out to the V4 internet for those that actually need it.
Right. And they were following in the footsteps to some extent of T-Mobile.
Yeah. Yeah. They were definitely, there were some, a lot of parallels in terms of what they were doing effort-wise with what T-Mobile had already done within their network. So I think there was good learning lessons for them to go out and sort of borrow from, as it would be.
So if you have a V6 only network, then your end hosts only run one protocol, right? If it's a handset, then maybe it's a V6 only handset in the case of T-Mobile or Reliance Jio. So it doesn't have IPv4 running.
Yeah, so you have to fake it out. Right? So we have to fake it out. There's a couple different ways. So like on the iPhone, I think iPhone doesn't support 6.4.6.x a lot. So you're V6 only. And so you need something to basically provide some sort of translation service for you. But if you're on an Android handset, you can run a small little shim stack on the handset. And if the handset has an application that requires something to talk to V4, The handset can sort of locally do that for you, sort of lie to you locally within the handset.
And this is really lightweight code, right? I mean, these little shims that we're talking about.
Yeah, they're not particularly complex. I mean, they're doing a very simple process of just basically, you know, doing a protocol conversion. It doesn't look any different than what we're traditionally sort of used to with NAT. Right. So if you're doing network address translation from V4 to V4, it doesn't look really that much structurally different than V4 to V6. But the 646X lat is just a small little piece of code that allows a local IPv4 network stack to exist on the Android handset for the application to basically attach or bind to for V4, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's able to basically open a socket, a V4 socket, right? Mm-hmm. If the app needs that, because it's not aware of how to use V6 at all.
Right.
So it hasn't been ported or it hasn't been updated and you need to be able to support it. That's what it does. It gives it that socket to bind to, and then it goes through the process of going ahead and converting that over to V4, and then it pops out the other side and gets translated back to from V6 to V4 through the process that actually the rest of the client operating systems, Apple iOS in this case, use DNS64 and NAT64. Mm-hmm. And so the 646X lat does the same thing. It basically fakes it out on the handset, provides it as V6, and then says, please provide me, you know, to connect me to whatever V4 resource is required.
Yeah.
So basically just tunnels on top. It's not sophisticated. It's pretty reliable. It's clearly very scalable because, mm-hmm. right, in terms of meeting the mobile market need.
And it's even simpler in the service provider core, right? Because you basically have the whatever your routing protocols are and the overlays. You basically have IPv6 support and have had it for quite some time. And configuration is, you know, if it's not trivial, it's no different than really any of the other routing protocols you'd be deploying in IPv4.
Yeah, I don't think that's. I think for the service providers, this becomes a much better story. In fact, you know, anecdotally, I think we've all heard that, you know, with the merger of T-Mobile and Sprint, right? Both of them were running relatively good size IPv6 networks, and one of the comments we sort of heard off the side is, hey, it hasn't been as painful to actually do the merger portion of this because we're just running V6 address space. It's just routing. Mm-hmm. So that part of the network is actually not as bad as we thought it was going to have to be for some of the merger work. So I think those are advantages that you're going to see in the service provider space. These are obviously very different than what you would see for an enterprise, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to ask. So now how do we make the parallel to the enterprise here? Where is the first place in the enterprise where IPv6 only is even a remote possibility?
Yeah, I maybe Scott can make a comment on this. I think like IoT space and like when you're going to start getting ready to deploy sensor networks, you're going to start, you know, building control systems. There's going to be other things that are going to start leveraging that, that are going to be at least for a campus, probably a logical place to start, along with, you know, potentially your backbone if you're a large enough enterprise and you're actually running, you know, an MPLS backbone of your own. It might make sense to, you know, run other services on top of that and keep your topology simple and convert that over to V6 only. But there could be other use cases that make a lot of sense too.
Data center maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or a cloud if you can control the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Anywhere where you're starting net new and you don't want, and you have modern software and you're not bound by having to support a broad range of diverse endpoints, and you're controlling, you know, who can talk to who. Yeah.
And you can do the proxying at the edge, DNS64, NAT64, or even just mm-hmm. if it's a web server, you know, or mm-hmm. you can just run a proxy on that web server that converts, you know, on the outside from V4 to V6 if that's what you need. And those mm-hmm. are all pretty scalable solutions these days.
Yeah. Server load balancers are going to allow you to do a lot of things to get around all those sorts of issues. So yeah, the proxy or server load balancer is going to solve a lot of those related problems. So I think for enterprises, if you're running large scale data center, like really large scale data center, big processing facility or something like that, then and I mean by data processing facility, not necessarily like processing vegetables facility, you're gonna see some advantages for going V6 only there.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like you haven't had lunch, Ed.
No. But yeah, I think those are some of the use cases. I don't know, Scott. I mean, is there, Tom, do you guys think of anything else that might jump out? Well, in terms
the one that's conspicuous in its absence is obviously the desktop. And I don't think any of us are going to propose that you try to go to an IPv6 only environment where you're actually running network services out to the client desktops that end users are using. Within the office, of course, these days, everybody's working from home. And so then you really get into the requirement of having VPN and how IPv6 impacts VPN connectivity. And that's, we've talked a little bit about that in past episodes, but that's really, that can be pretty thorny if your organization hasn't really dealt with it.
Yeah, and the one exception may be that you need some test components for QA and lab tests that might be V6 only. So you might want to just validate and test to ensure that your site or services are accessible in a V6 only environment, and that you're not dependent on a V4 only resource, because the only way you're ever going to find that, right, mm-hmm. is by testing via V6 only. And that gets a little weird, because there's some things in the host operating systems that we have today that maybe don't behave necessarily in the way that we would think in a V6 only environment. I don't know if maybe we can talk through some of those, because they're a little odd in corner cases, right? Because you typically, you just never run V6 only networks, so you're not going to see right. This stuff.
Yeah, in the past at our IPv6 conferences, we've tried to create a V6 only wireless SSID to let people try it out and see what breaks, you know, in that situation. If you had a host that was on a V6 only network, well, it would fail doing DHCP for its IPv4 address. It'd end up with an APIPA, APIPA address, a 169.254 address. Then it would go through the process of getting a V6 address through, however, the RA indicated, SLAC, RDNSS, DHCP V6, what have you. So yeah, your mileage may vary depending on the host OS device that was brought to the conference.
Yeah, and you may get on the network in terms of, like, you have a valid V6 address, you don't have a valid V4 address, but you have no way of actually looking up any DNS related information, right? There's a mm-hmm. there's a couple places you can fall between the cracks, is what I mean. Mm-hmm. And even though you're up and operational, you can't actually look any information up unless you can connect to a reliable DNS service. And then if your operating system didn't have the right version to support, you know, RDNSS, right? And what is it, RFC 6106, 8106 now? I think 8106 is the current. You're gonna have structural problems of actually name resolving. So so that's sort of unique. And then depending on which operating system you have, for instance, that wireless network was set up with DHCP V6 only, right? Mm-hmm. And your operating system only supported SLAC, but it doesn't have a DHCP V6 client. Mm-hmm. Then you're stuck in this, like, I'm not getting any address on V6 and I'm getting an APIP address in V4, I really can't talk to anything.
Right? Yeah.
Except for link local maybe and the APIPA, the other adjoining APIPA addresses. So if I have MDNS operating, I'm still able to, like, do Apple AirPlay and AirDrop and stuff like that, mm-hmm. but I'm not able to do anything else on this network, right?
Yeah, I've got a question for someone who knows a lot about, you know, Windows and IPv6. I don't know who I'd ask this question of, but, you know, we have in Windows host OSs, we have network connectivity status indicator,
right.
And it tries to go out to the internet and survey, does the host OS have reliable, we tend to think of it as testing if it has reliable V6 connectivity, and it uses that then in its happy eyeballs, like, algorithm for making a connection. And in my IPv6 labs, I have to fake this out because they might be isolated from the host being able to get to that Akamai service that's serving up that V6 only NCSI page. I tend to not think of it in the reverse. So if you had a V6 only Windows 10 host, let's say, and there are components of network connectivity status indicator that use V4 and V6, the V6 would work, the test mm-hmm. would work, but the V4 test would fail, right?
Yeah, so you get this weird use case where it's, so very commonly for people on the V4 side, you'll see the little thing like, you know, hey, you're not connected to the internet. You get the mm-hmm. little sort of alarm box on the where your network status normally is and says, hey, you're not connected to the internet, or it's able to detect a proxy because it's trying to go to NCSI. The URL for that, and it expects a certain set of text string back. If it doesn't get it, if it gets something else like a login banner, it'll say, hey, I can get to, it looks like I have network access, but it looks like there's a proxy or you need to log in or you need to do something else. So I'm going to use that to auto open, you know, whatever your default browser is and display that page for you. So you can either log in or you get the alert. And yes, those things will sort of fail and you have to have an understanding of how they're failing. So if you have V6 working, but V4 is not, it doesn't really change the network conductivity status indicator at all because you have reliable V6 internet connectivity outbound. And so it's going to pass that check. It won't pass the V4 check, but depending on what you're actually doing, I don't know if that really matters because what happens is, like you mentioned, for the happy eyeballs check, at least, V6 is up, it's going to prefer it anyway. And then there's a whole different RFC about source address selection. That's RFC 6724 that basically says V6 is preferred. So as long as it passes the V6 check, you're going to be off to the races. The problem is when you try and connect to something via V4 and you don't have a translation mechanism, it's going to fail. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to get to a V4 only related service, you're going to get an A record back for your DNS query because DNS is still working. And at that point, it's just going to pop up an error and say, you know, hey, we can't connect because we don't have a mechanism. Yeah. Now, if you have a translation mechanism in place, that'll work just fine, right? If you have a method out there. So if you have, you know, sort of DNS64, NAT64 operating, all that will work for you, assuming that you don't use an actual IPv4 address. If you're using DNS to look everything up, you're going to be fine. If you're using an actual address embedded in there, you're going to have issues.
Yeah, I think, and we need to be clear that we're talking about an infrastructure solution on your side to DNS64, NAT64. So yeah, the host is trying to access something over V4. It can't because there's no translation mechanism in place. That translation mechanism should exist on your network. Of course, in most cases, it's dual stack and you're running just native V4 anyway. And so it's dual stack to the desktop. So that's of kind of a corner case, but you definitely want to have to think that through. It's like, if I'm going to try to do IPv6 only, there are some resources out there that are still IPv4 only on the internet, not to mention whatever might be local to your network. But of course, that probably typically wouldn't be the issue within the network. You'd uncover those potential places where it wouldn't be able to connect, you know, pretty quickly, but the ones hiding out there on the internet that are V4 only, you'd run into those and not really have a good idea for why that was happening if you hadn't really planned.
And to pivot on that really quickly, one of the reasons you don't have to worry as much about your internal ones is probably because you're already running them through a load balancer. So all you would end up doing is setting up V6 for the VIPs that you run that, and then translate those back to a V4 real. And you're off to the races. You don't have to worry about that side of it. And so it's actually a pretty trivial process to get basically most of your V4 services up and operational as a V6 behind the same server load balancer that you're probably already using today for all of those services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a proposal, a draft that expired a year ago called IPv6 router advertisement IPv6 only flag that was proposing an S flag that indicated to hosts that they would be on an IPv6 only network. If the flag was set to 1, it could indicate to the host, hey, you're V6 only, so behave accordingly. Right. Or if it was a 0, it'd be like, oh, it's not V6 only, might be dual in the RA. So, but that draft expired, but interesting idea of how could we clue in the host to say, here's the type of network you're on.
Yeah, I think it shortcuts a bunch of different things. Number one, you don't need to run happy eyeballs. If you've got a V6 only network, like shut that process off within the operating system, within the browsers, right?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, don't worry about that. Like stop worrying about that stuff because there is no performance measurement between V4 and V6 because V4 is never going to respond back to you. So if V6 isn't responding, you just have a whole different network problem, right? I think that would be first and foremost. You also get you short circuit a bunch of stuff in RFC 6724 for checks. So you can just bypass like probably 3/4, 7/8 of RFC 6724 and not even worry about it. So I think there's a lot of things that are advantages of the host operating system understanding that it's on a V6 only network. Just structurally, I think the one challenge I do see with it, and I'd love to hear your guys' thought around this, is the first thing I would do is set up, you know, a rogue RA and start advertising S flags on everyone's V4 only networks. because every single system would be like, okay, I'm on a V4 only network. I have no V6 intentionally, so but then I get this flag from this from this RA that says like I'm a V6 only network, and I don't know what the host would do then. So that's maybe that's my evil thinking around that side of it. But yeah,
well, the draft expired, so maybe, I mean, was that part of the reason why the security issue there, and then trying to figure out like who's going to own that, where that problem is going to be owned, terms of the.
It's funny.
The router and host exchange.
Yeah, it's funny. I've never been happy with the whole flags thing around like, oh, you need to set a flag for the RA for, you know, for router advertising. It's DHCP v6 versus Slack versus something else, because turning one on implies the other is off, but it doesn't actually work that way.
Right.
So you could have this flag on and then still have v4 operating on the network.
Oh, yeah.
And there's no way to know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's one of these strange things where it's like, it's not like V6 is going to have any visibility to the V4 network. You just sort of have to trust that the operator knows what they're doing.
You're right. And I've gotten a RA from a well-known service provider where all the flags are set, and mm-hmm. it comes with RDNSS option 25. So mm-hmm. I end up with a DHCP address, a link local, a privacy, a temporary. Like, how many addresses do I need here?
What do we call that? The Christmas tree configuration?
Christmas tree RA, because it's got all the lights lit. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, and then of course, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think this fits in the same situation. What do you do when this flag is on?
Right. Well, and in the grand tradition that we've seen of things not matching in the auto addressing space, right? You know, we have this like classic problem of, oh, well, we don't have operating systems that support DHCP v6. Well, one in particular, you know, now we've got a similar situation with this IPv6 only option where the draft for Slack and the S flag died on the vine. But meanwhile, the RFC for our DHCP v4 was published with an IPv6 only preferred option. Mm-hmm. So, you know, of course, it's easier just to jam a DHCP option, throw a DHCP option at whatever you're trying to fix. Mm-hmm. So I understand from a technical standpoint why that would be the case. But now here again, we have something that works in DHCP that doesn't work in Slack.
And the issues that we've talked about in the past, where you might get DHCP for your V4 DNS resolver, and that might override, or via DHCP V6, and that might override the one that came in the DNSSL in the RA.
Which one's preferred?
You know, in which case, DHCP, in which operating system? And
yeah, DHCP is almost universally preferred versus. Mm-hmm. Anything happening, just for the listeners to know, to leave you hanging. But as a general rule of thumb, the DHCP one is considered more trusted, so it's preferred. The real question is what happens on failback, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, so I've got one via V4, I've got one via Slack V6. My DHCP V6 is no longer I've expired my TTL. So what do I choose next? I think that's those become very difficult sort of nuanced things for each operating system in terms of how they behave and sort of understanding that.
Yeah.
And get back to Tom's original point, because he glossed over it really quickly. Why don't we talk a little bit more in detail about this IPv6 only preferred option for DHCP v4? Because that's just like, that's a mouthful that just sounds weird on the face of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should back up and explain like why you might want that. I mean, the listeners are probably inferring it already, but explicitly, why would we want to do that?
Just to indicate to a host what type of a network it is, to bypass some of it trying to feel its way around in the dark, you know?
Right.
Same kind of thing as the S flag, right?
Right. And it's kind of like moving the responsibility of where to track that around a little bit. I mean, if you're giving the host operating system a clue, right, a big, big fat clue, it's like, okay, so then how is that going to be? How are the operating system developers going to then treat that information and incorporate it into, you know, things like network connectivity status indicator and how that's mm-hmm. doing address selection, et cetera. I mean, you're kind of giving it, you know, it's giving away the game here. It's like, well, you don't have to think about IPv4. You mm-hmm. don't have to actually go out and test for IPv4 because it's not running on the network.
Well, I think the other,
of course,
thing is the race condition. So it's the DHCP v6. Mm-hmm. This now tells every operating system developer, I have to do DHCP v6 first. If I get a, mm-hmm. if I get a response set back that has this set, I do not send a DHCP IPv4 request out to get an address. Mm-hmm. Like, don't do it, because, right, this is telling me I should be only on an IPv6 network I should only do this first set of process. And so there might actually be some delay, and the timers are going to really matter on this, right? In terms of like, I'm not getting a response back from V6 on the DHCP V6 side. How long do I wait before I determine whether I send out something for DHCP V4 or do I send one out? And if I get a response back, I just drop it on the floor. So even though I quote unquote can set myself a V4 address and I've consumed one from the DHCP server standpoint, I'm going to send the message back and say, hey, didn't need it, right? Didn't need it. Go ahead and clear that thing back up. I'm on a V6 only network and I'm all good to go.
Yeah. The Internet Assigned Number Authority has allocated this new option, DHCP option 108, and it has a value, which is a number, and that's the number of seconds to wait. And there's some default timers in the RFC defined. There's a minimum V6 only wait time of 300 seconds or 5 minutes. And then there's a default V6 only wait of 1800 seconds, which would be 30 minutes.
30 minutes, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Even 5 minutes.
Yeah, but that's the amount of time that we want the client to disable its DHCP V4 for. Right.
Yeah, we should be really clear too. Also, I mean, this RFC was just published.
Yeah, so it came out.
It's going
to
be a while before we see it.
It's going to be one of those things where there's going to be a lot of initial server code probably available for it, but I don't know how quickly the clients are going to catch up to speed for making use of this.
Pay attention to the option. Yeah,
yeah.
Because let's say you know they had moved forward with an S flag in the RA. All the you have to upgrade all your router code to get the S flag in there, and then you have to upgrade all the host OSs to pay attention to the S flag.
Or not break when they see an S flag. That's the other thing.
Like and we just saw the vulnerability this last week of Windows hosts with RDNSS and parsing those options had a bug. And so now you got to patch them, and anything you need the host to do that's new code could potentially be vulnerable. Yeah.
And by the way, that is patched. So everyone's making a big deal about it. Stop.
Yeah. So you're right, Ed. Just if you were thinking about this new DHCP V4 option 108, like thinking like an attacker, what if I could generate one of these or get hosts to listen to option 108 and then turn off their V4 stack? If they're on a V4 only network, I could turn everybody off. There's a section 6 in the RFC that describes the security implications.
I'm glad that the ITF is evil thinking just like me.
Fortunately only white hats listen to our show. Mm-hmm. So
you could always turn off your V4 stack manually. There are other methods to turn off V4 if you did want to do a V6 only network.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of, let's bring that up. That's a reverse of what most people are doing, right? Most people are trying to go out there and disable V6 to some degree, even though it makes us all cry into our beer. And I think I think the reality is this, and then I politely remind them, at least for the Windows operating system, that's not really possible, right? I mean, you can do a bunch of group policy objects, you can do a bunch of PowerShell and NetSH commands, and you can reduce the impact of V6, but it's still always going to have that, :\1, loopback address on there. You can still always, connect to it from a socket basis. You just can't turn that off fundamentally within the networking stack because of how they built IPv4 and IPv6 side by side next to each other. It's not something you can remove. It's not like in the old days prior to Windows Vista when you loaded an additional networking protocol stack, and that was IPv6. You just don't have that option, which meant you could unload V4. By the way, you don't have that option here, and so the reverse is true too. You can't actually turn V4 off in the same way. So if you're trying to run a V6 only network, 127.0.0.1 is still going to be available to the operating system. It can still open a socket to it. It can still process requests to that address. So you're never going to truly get it turned off until we move sufficiently past needing V4 that maybe they decide to just make it a shim stack again, and V6 is your primary, and then you have to load a V4 stack in order to support V4. But today, in terms of Windows, that's not an option. You can't truly disable V4. You can't truly disable V6. You have both available in the operating system, and that's that.
I guess all this just shows that there's a spectrum of phases that an organization goes through on their way towards a V6 only network. There might be things you do near term, you know, like maybe just not turning off IP, trying to go around and turn off IPv6, mid-phase things, which is run dual protocol and let happy eyeballs sort it out. And then there's late stage, you know, techniques when we're thinking far in advance, you know, these things like how would I make a host function V6 only? You may not need it today, but it's something to keep your eye on the horizon, because that's where you're going to end up, is in this, in every organization's different. Some organizations may be more aggressive about V6 and they need these options now. Some, they won't get to this stage in their journey to IPv6 for 10 years, but we have thought about these things along the way.
Yeah. And this is why it's important to have a roadmap and a plan, right? Mm-hmm. If you're thinking about V6 only, you want to sort of be able to sort of envision where your hiccups and maybe bumps and forks in the road are going to be, so that you know at what point you need to deploy what sets of technologies to sort of overcome that, and what sort of testing you need to be thinking about doing. So you're exactly right, Scott. It's really that, you know, right solution at the right time in regards to sort of adoption for a V6 only solution offering. And I think there are many companies that are really seriously looking at, you know, V6 from a, you know, especially around the V6 only data center. I mean, the good examples are Facebook and LinkedIn, right? Where they're really pushing the envelope about what can be supported within those environments, because they want to deal with a single protocol. They don't want to deal with running multiples. They want to get the unbridled, unconstrained resources of that V6 provides them in terms of building their infrastructure, and not having to think about that carefully about planning around, you know, a whole V4 address plan. But there are some challenges that still exist today. I mean, one of the ones that LinkedIn sort of highlights is the whole Pixie boot process, right? If you're using automation all the way from Pixie boot all the way up to be able to bring infrastructure in, there's still some challenges in Pixie boot, right, for V6 only. That maybe if you're not familiar, they have some articles that are published out there in terms of talking about some of the structural deficiencies in terms of trying to boot your, you know, zero touch provision your environment and then get that up and operational, in terms of like MAC address reservations versus like what you have to do with IID and AIDs, DUIDs, every single other AIID, but yeah, that's, I still think there's areas for improvement for V6 as more operators start to try and figure out that particular problem space within the data center. I think that's going to be, you know, an important thing to get addressed in the market overall. Well, hey, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. So you can reach all of us on the IPv6 Buzz podcast at Twitter. It's at IPv6 Buzz, but you can hit up Tom at IPv6 Tom. You can hit up Scott at Scott Hoag. You can hit me up at E. Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And if you like the show, you know, please give us a rating on iTunes. It's always appreciated. If you like this podcast, then we really recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break, you know, all the other great technical content over at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.